Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%. APR, 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and today with the Cam Raslan, we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan Ampike Parkin.
Hello, Cam.
And we have another BFM acolyte, Mr. Tech Man, Matthew Armitage.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm good. Sorry, also known as Matt Armitrage.
Yes.
And our three topics this week is topic number one, AI, the future of. Topic number two is 13 reasons why. And finally, topic number three is upgrading, good or bad. So now with AI, or also known as, I forgot what it's called, it, artificial intelligence.
That's the one.
Why am I thinking Victoria Institution? That's VI. And and obviously, folks, I don't necessarily know so much about this, but I have the two people I turn to for tech information because I've been seeing headlines recently quoting people who know a thing or two about artificial intelligence saying how frightened they are for the future about the possibilities of what it can do. And I'm wondering, should I be frightened? Especially if, for instance, we talk about, say, for young people, and who knows, there may even be young people listening to us now, and the job market in a world where artificial intelligence is becoming a reality or is a reality, I guess is. Should I be scared?
Yes.
No. Yeah, it's a really, really difficult topic because what we're seeing now is people in previously secure middle-class occupations being threatened by this kind of technology and mechanization that has already wiped out a lot of blue-collar jobs. You know, robots and just machinery in general have made laboring and unskilled jobs very thin on the ground, which is why everyone now works in call centers. But what we're now seeing is the technology getting to the point where it's starting to make inroads into
call centers.
Well, yeah. But it inroads into the lives of accountants and lawyers and architects and doctors and all of these things in these, what we used to think of as these kind of exalted and protected professions. So really, it's only the sort of upper echelons of society who are feeling this fear now, because everyone else in society has been feeling the fear of machinery for generations already.
Right. Yeah, that was mechanization previously.
It's part and parcel of the same system. Yeah, because it's just a layer of system on top of a layer of system. So a machine didn't have the ability to threaten the job of a lawyer before, but a machine with intelligence does.
And it's just because of the march of technology, right? The more processes that can take place within a specific nanosecond means the faster computers can process information and algorithms and outcomes, right? That's the most important thing. I mean, the earliest brush that we probably had with our own insecurities as human beings is probably Deep Blue, when IBM challenged Garry Kasparov, right?
The chess machine
challenged Garry Kasparov and won.
Yeah.
And for us, it was always this idea that chess was a human game. It requires this incredible brain power to strategize. But of course, here comes a machine that can run these calculations a million, billion times faster than Garry ever could.
Well, in that case, though, what I would want to know is, what was Garry Kasparov wearing?
was he kind of sexy looking?
Exactly. Was it revealing?
Did he distract Deep
yeah,
Blue?
Exactly. And it didn't work, did it?
It didn't work.
Clearly
it didn't work. But no, I think that was our first brush with our own sense of mortality. Like, oh God, here's a machine that's smarter than us. And even that isn't that smart. That was two decades ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, with the kind of processing power and intelligence these machines have.
I think as well there's a bit of a misnomer when we say artificial intelligence. What we're actually really looking at is algorithms, little bits of mathematics. It's not intelligent in the same way that we are. There's not so much of a deductive reasoning process. It's much more of a statistical analysis. And that's why it is making inroads into these areas, because when you look at professions like law, there's a lot of repetition. in law, there's a lot of standardization. So a little script, a code script, can take that on board. In accountancy, it's computation. And again, obviously, that lends itself to machinery taking over.
Well, can I ask you, though, with law? I was talking to a lawyer the other day who works for a very big law firm, regional law firm. She was saying how lawyers are being cut out of many negotiations now because two parties meet and they type in their situation, their demands, and then the result comes out, which is precedents from previously. So they then agree, okay, so it's 5 million. That's the precedent. We'll pay it. We don't have to pay any lawyers this way.
Before we continue with this conversation, at least the three of us in this room, we can agree that less lawyers is better, right?
Well, no, I'm wondering. I'm wondering though. But the thing is that these precedents are the precedents that they're using are from the past.
Yeah.
So, how are we creating new precedents?
Yeah.
Because there will still be a negotiation in the way that laws are formed. The new laws will be formed by the lawmakers, which are generally members of government who pass the laws down, or they will be argued in court, still by lawyers in front of a judge. But what we're talking about is a lot of the mechanical volume of law being taken over by these machines. So we still have human lawyers who will be signing off on everything. But what you don't need is 1,000 lawyers working on your account.
Mm.
You only need 100. You only need lawyers to do the thinking work, not lawyers to go back and look through case histories from hundreds of years ago.
The young lawyers. Those are the young, newly arrived lawyers, and they don't have work to do. They're just qualified. They've got nothing to do.
They'll still be able to shadow the senior lawyers. There will still be work for them to do. It's just you won't see an item on your bill saying photocopying $14 million.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So the problem then is, jobs aside, end of the world stuff.
Yeah, that's what I want to ask.
That's what Cam's really concerned about.
Are they going to become self-aware? Bit of a leap here. I know we're just talking about jobs and lawyers, but what I really want to know is, are computers going to Terminator-style become self-aware and Skynet?
The interesting thing about Skynet is that it became self-aware maybe, but it was using military strategy based on logic that humanity was useless to the progress of the machine. So it was still working upon very basic fundamentals. It wasn't thinking for itself. It didn't necessarily hate humanity. Everything was based on logic and reasoning, which was already programmed into this kind of machine logic. So it's difficult to assume that we're going to build a robot that'll somehow become self-aware, develop emotions like love and hate, and then realize that it's so much more superior than us and then wipe us out. I don't see that as a reality.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. And because, again, we're talking about intelligence in a very different form. So even as the machines start to build other machines, there's no suggestion that we will ever become anything that they even consider. Our intelligence won't register to them in the same way that we're not able to understand their intelligence. We'll just go off on our separate paths. When we make these kind of decisions, we're using our own processes and our own history to decide that this thing is going to become more intelligent than us and wipe us out. But if you're looking at intelligence that's not of a human form, why would it even think about eradicating you in the first place?
All right, okay. I guess it's a ray of sunshine. I don't know. Well, remember the character in Battlestar Galactica? There was this one character who betrayed humankind to work with
Gaius,
yeah? And he embraced his new alien overlords.
That's right.
I want to be that guy. So I just want to, I'm just preparing the ground, learning from you people how to then betray you when the time comes. So with that happy thought in mind, we'll move on to topic number two.
Suicide.
Yes, which is indeed that, with 13 Reasons Why.
That's right. It's a hot new series on Netflix. It's based on a novel of the same name. And essentially, the story, for those who don't know, it's this 13-episode arc that tells the story about a girl who's killed herself. And the TV series starts with her already being dead. And she has these 13 cassette tapes delivered to the people who have somehow influenced her death. And she tells her story through these cassette tapes. She's essentially, in some ways, podcasting her own death. The TV series, I say movie because it kind of feels like that. It's like one long 13-hour film, right? The TV series plays out in a very clever, creatively shot, very well-written manner. It's, by all aesthetic reasons, an incredibly great piece of work. It has, however, received a lot of criticism out in the larger world, right, because of its approach to suicide, the way it's discussed suicide, a lot of people think that maybe it reinforces this notion that suicide is a form of revenge on the people who did you wrong. Another side feels that it reinforces this other notion that suicide is somehow a way for people to realize how beautiful a soul you were. Because now you're dead, they're missing you, and they realize what they've lost. And they think this is bad, incredibly bad for people with suicidal tendencies. Another thing they do in this TV series, which is quite graphic, is that later on in the series, I mean, it's not really a spoiler per se, because you know she's dead. They show you how she dies, right? And they show you how she does it. Incredibly graphic, incredibly jarring. Now, I've never had suicidal tendencies myself, but when I watch it, I know, oh, I never want to do that again. But some people who have been through that say that that actually might be bad for people who have suicidal tendencies because you're showing them in graphic detail how it can happen.
But it's graphic and unattractive.
Totally unattractive.
Right, so it's not like, was it The Death of Chatterton? There's this romantic poet.
Yes, it doesn't romanticize it in any way. This is gruesome and just awful to watch. And painful to watch, right?
Okay, so that shouldn't encourage anybody.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it's like in the mind of someone with suicidal tendencies. Mm. But the reason I wanted to bring this up was because obviously there looks like there will be a second season to this TV show. And the story continues, right?
13 more reasons.
13 more reasons, maybe. Or focus on another character. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I found more tapes. But I'm always curious as to the creative process, because there are a lot of criticism has been leveled against Netflix and against the people who create this TV series. And my question is, from a creative point of view, it is actually incredibly well executed and just almost beautifully done. But at the same time, what responsibility does a TV show like this have beyond just warning people with suicidal tendencies don't watch it? Does it have a greater responsibility? Because the op-eds that have come out make it seem as if Netflix, the creators, have done something wrong.
The topic that I almost did for today was actually blaming the format. And I think that's something that we do inherently. I mean, there's all the discussion over the Facebook Live murders, for example.
That's right.
And we blame Facebook for that. We're blaming the format rather than the tool just being a mirror of our own society.
No, but even if you blame the creator of this, I mean, the creator of this told the story and told it really well. It's a very compelling story.
No, but I think there's much more of a culture now of apologizing for art, for having to give these warnings to people, trigger warnings, and saying, oh, you shouldn't do this if blah, blah, blah. I think we've got into this very kind of defensive position, whereas, you know, if you go back even just a couple of decades, art was a lot more aggressive. I think it challenged a lot more. But if you go back to the 1970s and the emergence of the punk movement, which was an economic response, it was a countercultural response. Where is that kind of parallel in today's cultural movement? I mean, we have Donald Trump, we have all of these authoritarian leaders moving across the world, but we don't have that same response from musicians and writers and TV makers that we had back then. It's all couched a lot more politely.
Yeah, but we got Miley Cyrus, so, you know.
Yeah.
Right?
She needs a trigger warning.
No, but so what you're saying is Facebook doesn't kill people, people kill people.
Well, essentially, I mean, I know it's a bit of a cop-out, but we've got to this point now where our first reaction is not to blame the person who committed the crime, but to blame the person that made the tool that enabled them to broadcast it to other people.
Sadly, that the first reaction nowadays is to come up with some conspiracy theory as to why it didn't even happen. But
that comes later in the evening, yeah.
But can I ask a question? 13 Reasons Why, is it aimed at an adolescent market?
Yes, for sure. It was a young adult novel. The story is told in a very young adult style of television.
What was that one where she's dying and in her coma, she has to decide whether or not she wishes to live or not.
Yeah, oh, there was a movie. I remember that.
Because I am so bang up to date, if I can just go back to the early 19th century for a moment and look at the Romantic movement and a thing called Sturm und Drang, where in that time they suddenly celebrated suicide as being the ultimate romantic proposition. So instead of accepting the banality and the normalcy of the world, you would step outside of that. And you would do the one and only thing you could do, which is the greatest artistic action, which is to end yourself in the way that you choose. Suicide is wrapped up with...
A lot of baggage.
A lot of romance. And young adolescents who are, if they're anything like I was, you know, grumpy and non-communicative, it's like, oh, you don't understand me and the whole world hates me.
But is it any different from the 1980s when there was a coalition of politicians that were saying, you know, all heavy metal was driving teens to suicide? I mean, in...
Past youth still says that.
But you mentioned punk. I mean, that was nihilistic. The lyrics were usually in the negative.
Yeah.
I'm going to smash it all up, burn it all down.
They were anarchists.
They're anarchists. But with the energy of that, I mean, you formed a community of like-minded people and you found solace in that. But the actual, the words themselves were about destruction.
But I think it was Black Sabbath were actually put on trial for one of their albums inciting suicide in a couple of teens. Yeah. And there was a whole movement under Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife, which brought in the rating system for...
That was because of Prince, though, wasn't it?
No, it was from a lot of artists, rap artists especially. I mean, it also speaks to various cultural and racist themes in the States as well, because it mainly targeted black music artists rather than white artists. But the musicians at that time fought back. Dee Snider, who was the lead singer of Twisted Sister, actually gave evidence, I think, in the Senate, before a Senate committee.
Very eloquent as well.
He's very, very eloquent, even though I can't say the word eloquent. No, but it also showed that the people within these bands weren't the mindless fools that were being portrayed through the media.
But just wrap up, though. So with 13 Reasons Why, we have a bunch of TV producers.
It's a commercial venture beyond anything else.
Yeah. Who are tapping into a trait that lies in all, not all, but quite a number of adolescents.
A number of adolescents across the world. The stories you hear in the TV show are stories we've heard in real life across American public schools, so it's rooted in the real as well. There are stories of rape and abuse and all of these things that happen, and the lack of access that a lot of young women have is portrayed in great detail in this TV series, and which just happens to drive one particular young woman to kill herself. And I think it is how real a lot of these depictions are. Mm. That's almost the problem. And that's why people have reacted in that way.
But is that the problem, that adults find the realness a problem? Because the kids don't.
Yeah.
Because that's part of the world that they're living in. But we as adults look down on that and say, oh no, kids should be protected from that. But you can't protect them from these things.
You can't. And I also don't think art should apologize for it either.
No, of course.
Well, bad art should apologize.
We must move on. But I think we'd finish off, though, just by saying that we're with the kids.
I think we're with the kids.
We're in favor of
the kids are all right.
The kids are united. I'll check it out, though. I'll check it out, 13 Reasons Why. But in a moment, we come to topic number three. Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Uma Parkin, Amike Parkin, and Matt Armitage. And so now, topic number three, Matt, constant upgrades.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, are we erasing our history? You know, we just kind of blithely accept that we go on to the newest, better version of something. You know, we spend a lot of time developing a Friendster profile, and then when Friendster's not really doing it for us anymore, then we move on to... I didn't, because I only had a dial-up connection back then in Ampang, and it just wasn't fast enough to get onto Friendster. I had a MySpace profile. I had a few fake ones. But then, of course, you know, you move on to Facebook, but you leave behind all this information. You put a lot of time and effort, and a lot of your personal history is catalogued in these places, but you suddenly decide, no, this isn't doing it for me anymore, or my friends aren't here anymore, and you move on to something else. And as more and more of our culture goes into this kind of digital space, are we making it too ephemeral? Are historians in 2 or 3 or 1,000 years' time going to look back at this period and actually find anything that will tell them about the way we live now? If they find a smartphone, they'll just be finding a shiny piece of glass and metal. They won't be able to turn it on. They won't be able to look at any of the information inside it.
Because Apple would have changed the cables and you just can't use it anymore.
No, because we just forget about
we do.
Format. You know, there are various archives for defunct formats, but if you have a floppy disk at home, chances are, even if you've got a drive that you can put the thing into, you can't open it because none of your computers read those file formats or that software anymore. What do you do with a WordPerfect file from 1992, or even earlier word processing files. You know, there's an awful lot of work that gets created. When you look at the work of artists, we don't always just look at their finished works. We look at drafts, we look at the process, the early version. If all of the process is digital in a format that nobody can open in 200 years' time, where's it gone?
I would say, much as I do with the new Apple upgrades, I just press, I agree. So therefore, what you're saying? What should we do? What can we do?
I mean, we have to be a little more cognizant, I think, of what we're doing. I mean, when you look at all of the relics that we have of past civilizations, things that people carve on stone, we still have them 2,000 or 3,000 years later. It wasn't that they were designed to last for 2,000 or 3,000 years. It just happens to be that the form they were using has lasted. Cave paintings, you know, if you put something on the wall of a cave in the middle of a mountain, the chances are not much is going to happen to the mountain, and there's a fairly good chance your paintings are going to survive. Graffiti on the back of a supermarket is probably not going to last for 10,000 years.
I agree with you in the sense of human output. I think that's very important. Cam, you just finished writing a novel, and it must have been a very different process because you would have written it on a computer, and whatever changes you would have made along the way would have been deleted on the computer and then typed over in a sense. Meanwhile, if you were writing a book on a piece of paper or in a notebook, you may scratch things out and move on, but you're still able to read the stuff that you've scratched out.
Yeah, well, actually, I carved mine in hieroglyphics on rock.
On 10 stone tablets.
Yeah. And I backed up on papyrus reed parchment.
No, but I think when it comes to that, when it comes to human creative output, I totally agree with you. I think upgrading with regards to technology, though, you said about the smartphone. I look at the smartphone as something eminently disposable, in that it only seems to get better. I think back about our old phones, and as items of design, they're beautiful. I don't need to switch them on to know that, because switching them on as objects of functionality, they're nowhere near as good as what we have today. So I would see them behind a glass pane in a museum and go, that was interesting, that Nokia 2310. But I don't have any other... have any other connection to it. However, you're right. As a musician, I would love to know what Don McLean's original lyrics to American Pie were.
But I think it's not just about the creative process. I mean, when we look at previous generations, we know a lot about them because of letters that they've sent to each other, or writing that they've had, or we know because of parish records. Once all of this stuff is digitized, how is somebody going to open it in 300 or 400 or 500 years' time? So if you look at a vinyl record, the chances are somebody is going to be able to work out that you put a needly thing on the surface
and
of it.
A tin can.
And
go round and round.
Yeah, round and round. Yeah. And you can hear the music. Yeah. Look at a compact disc, and no, you need a specific kind of laser to read it and to transfer the information and to come out. Even a cassette, it's not obvious to somebody who doesn't have access to the hardware that was used, how it was going to play.
I wonder, though, if we've been lulled into thinking that a lot of the things we do have a sort of keepability, is that a word, about them. Things that we never used to imagine could be kept. So all my WhatsApp messages, I can actually form some kind of connection to the archive of my WhatsApp and think that I must retain them when I change to a new phone. And I feel the loss. But, I mean, WhatsApp is a new creation. Why did I ever imagine that I want to keep them in the past?
No, I don't think it's quite that. I don't think that there's any inherent value to what's on my smartphone. I think it's just that, for example, if plague were to wipe out 90% of us in the next 100 years, population pops back, and in 10,000 years, you know, the archaeologists are looking through this era. What are they going to find? What, in terms of bodies of work, in terms of things that tell them about how people lived, what are they actually going to find?
There's happenstance about what has been found in the past, and we attach civilization to the places that happen to choose to, one, live in a very dry place where papyrus
would just last.
Preserves, yes, for sure.
And if they carved on rock, they carved on rock in a place that had very low rainfall so that it wasn't worn away. So we remember these places being a cradle of civilization. And we don't look at somewhere like, say, Peninsula Malaysia, because
there's nothing there.
Yes, dear. It's built in wood, and the granite is so hard you can't possibly carve. And so we just think that there was no civilization here.
Wait. So that being said, is there a greater impermanence now than there was then? I mean, in the sense that in my head, carving something into stone feels a lot more permanent than typing it out on WhatsApp.
I think there's a greater impermanence now, but also there's such a colossal volume of information that we are producing now that will not be preserved. Now, again, yes, 99% of that is of no value. But that 1%, is there going to be any way for that 1% to be opened, read, viewed? I mean, if somebody finds my Amazon Kindle buried deep in the mud in 10,000 years' time, they're just going to think it's a shiny plastic thing that you used to club a sheep to death with.
Yeah. But people are still trying to understand what, you know, Stonehenge was for.
Of course. But I think we need to at least put procedures into place where at least the formats can be preserved. In the same way that we have seed banks. I mean, we preserve seeds in deep storage zones in various parts of the world in case of calamity so that people have access to crops.
But they will start arguing about what should be kept there. You know, like, yes, no, Britney's second album has to be in.
Well, Miley Cyrus has to be in, of course.
Clearly.
Yeah. Okay, so once again, Matt, you leave us with a happy proposition. It seems to be your skill.
Thank you.
Feeling really, really depressed and impermanent right now.
No, but I'm feeling okay because I'm going to embrace our new robot overlords and they won't care about what we leave behind. Yeah. And I don't care either.
And I'll be writing the scripts for them, so I'll be controlling you too. So that's fine.
Damn it.
Dang.
So we move on though to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. So I go first and I'm going to recommend something I have not read, but I had a great conversation with Matt and it's something that I find absolutely fascinating. Wanting to recommend it, it's going to be the next book that I read, and I'm glad that he's given me the mark of approval. It's a book called Blitzed by a German writer by the name of
Norman Erler.
All right, there's no Michael in there at all. Norman Erler, and it's about the use of
methamphetamine in Nazi Germany,
and in their war machine in particular, and how the German war machine in the early days, especially, and in their blitzkrieg, lightning war, was fueled by pills of the highest order.
Amazing. So they weren't just murderous villains. They were also getting all of their people hooked on drugs.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is that the chief of health for Nazi Germany came out against methamphetamine, but he was just roundly ignored by the entire population, and the Wehrmacht, the German army, just basically told him to shut up.
And it's interesting to look at historical moments and to ask about simple things, you know, like diet.
Absolutely.
You know, and additives. Because while the Germans were high on methamphetamines, the British, their drug of choice was tea. And the French army that was overrun, their narcotic of choice was red wine. So Blitzed. It's the next book I'm going to read. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going to buy that too.
It's well worth it. I'm about halfway through.
All right. Very nice. And next, Uma.
Right. I'm going to recommend music. I'm recommending the soundtrack to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Oh.
It is called The Awesome Mix Volume 2. Oh. And it's got some fantastic 70s rockin' tracks. I mean, it's got Electric Light Orchestra. It's got Fleetwood Mac, Sam Cooke, George Harrison, Looking Glass, Cheap Trick, Parliament. It's got all of these great, great bands. And the music is incredibly tied into the film. James Gunn, as a director, loves imbuing his movies with music like this.
What else has he done?
He's done a really B movie called Slither, which is really, really fun. And of course, the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which was also very deeply rooted in the 70s and 80s rock. I mean, it's tied into the character whose mom was a big fan of that kind of music. And the music kind of works in conjunction with the film because the words of the song kind of really tie into the story arc of the movie as well. But it's really just toe-tapping music. I mean, I was watching this movie. I've seen it twice now. And I'm inadvertently tapping my feet throughout every scene because the music is so great and catchy.
You like movie soundtracks, don't you?
I love movie soundtracks.
Yeah, I'm not so hot on them myself.
But I think I love them so much only because they add that image to the song. So now if I'm driving in my car and listening to the song, I have the image of a massive space battle in my head and I'm avoiding KL traffic while that's going on.
Right.
Which is a lot of fun. I mean, I like that imagery that becomes associated with a popular song, for example.
I did not much like Guardians of the Galaxy.
So I've heard.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of rubbish.
So actually. I've heard.
I've not You're watched wrong, any of them yet.
Well, don't, Matt. Don't do it. Don't listen to him.
You know what? You're allowed to be wrong, Cameron.
Ooh, so magnanimous. Anyway, so that's the soundtrack to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Right, it's called Guardians of the Galaxy Awesome Mix Volume 2.
Okay. I'm sure the music's great.
And you know what? You don't even have to buy the soundtrack because it's all classic tracks. You can actually just create a playlist on YouTube and listen to it all.
I wouldn't have the visual triggers that you would have.
No, but it's the kind of music you enjoy anyway.
Okay, but I would be left wondering kind of like why they put together, you know.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Okay. And so, Matt, what's yours?
Mine is the fourth season of Line of Duty, which is one of my favourite British police shows. It's a police procedural. It's
really, really good.
Yes, it's very, very good. Of course, it concentrates on the cops who investigate the cops. So they're always after bad cops. The first sort of three seasons got quite deeply into institutional corruption in the Metropolitan Police Force. But the fourth season is absolutely incredible. It's honestly some of the best TV that Ooh. I have ever seen. Gosh. Thandie Newton is the police officer who is being investigated in this season. There is a serial killer. There is a high-level conspiracy within the police force. There are cops covering up and committing murders themselves. It got to the point where when I watched the end of episode 5, I could not believe I had to wait 7 days to see the last episode. I mean, it's very difficult to talk about it without giving away the plot because it's so complex. So I'm not going to, but every time you think you know what direction it's going to go in, it takes a 90-degree turn, and every time it just blows your mind.
That is one of the most kind of positive recommendations I think we've ever had.
From Mr. Matt Armitage.
From just about anybody, so we've got to check it out. Mm. Line of Duty.
Yes.
And each episode is its own particular story, or is
no,
it all
each,
part of a...
No, each season has a narrative arc, so there will be a cop who is being investigated in each season, so that serves as the main body. But in the background, there's always this ongoing thread of institutional corruption and links between gangsters and, you know, perverting the course of justice. So it all kind of threads in and around itself.
Being a British TV show, each season is like two episodes.
This one's six. They're about an hour each, so...
When I watch these things with my wife, she's like, these British people are so lazy. Why don't they make, like, American ones? 26 episodes.
Give me more. I want more.
Get on with it. I've got to wait till next year for another two episodes. But that's Line of Duty.
Line of Duty, yes.
It's now in season...
Season four. Definitely watch season one.
The only good thing is it's not going to take you long to catch up. It's six episodes.
It's six episodes each. Yeah, you can binge through in a weekend.
I've seen only the first three seasons. I'm yet to watch season four.
And you like it?
I love it.
Yeah, and season three does drift a bit. Don't let that put you off because it will take you to season four.
All right. Well, drifting a bit like this show. So we're okay with drifting a bit. And so we come to the end of the show and you can get in touch with us any which way. Upgrade to new systems. We're on Friendster. MySpace. What are the old? Any old ones?
Bebo.
You can email us on our Jarring account. Or even newfangled things like
Hotmail.
Hotmail. Anyway, you know the deal, folks. Like our page. Each like saves a soul from our new robot overlords.
That's right. Yes, I'm writing the script as we speak.
No, and I promise, if you press like, I will save you from our robot overlords in the future comes, when they go full Skynet. And so...
There'll be a special place for you in Putrajaya.
Yeah. that where they're going to be. Makes sense.
That's where I live.
That's why. So only remains for me now to thank special honored guest Matt Armitage.
Thank you, Cam.
And Umapagan Ampake Pagan.
Thank you very much, Cam.
And myself, Cam Ruslan. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%, APR 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.